Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Volcano! Volcano! Volcano!
From Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford, this is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolfe. If you're ever in the vicinity of a volcano, and that volcano started to erupt, your first and probably correct instinct would be to run as fast as you can in the opposite direction. But that cannot be said for the instincts of our guests today, each of whom have built careers around visiting and observing active volcanoes. You'll hear how David Garcia uses the heat of Guatemala's Pacaya volcano to serve up his signature volcanic pizza. And you'll meet Professor Leif Carlstrom, who combines his love for geology and music to compose symphonies from the sounds of volcanic eruptions. But first, we'll talk to award-winning photographer Brad White, who spent years visiting volcanoes around the world, risking his life to get the perfect, mesmerizing shot. Like a retired superhero, Brad White doesn't do that kind of stuff anymore. He's a grade school teacher now in Auckland, New Zealand, but in his previous life, he was lost in his longing to lock his lens upon lava. So, what's Brad's earliest memory of volcanoes?
I lived during my early years in Rotorua, which is in New Zealand, and it smells like rotten eggs. Of course, I've lived there for many years, and you just don't notice the smell until you go away and come back.
Do you like eggs, rotten or not?
Well, considering free-range eggs are getting really, really expensive, which is funny because when I have gone to volcanoes as I grow up, yeah, it's that familiar smell, which is quite nice and settling.
So you have grown up around volcanoes and their rotten, eggy smell. Why did you start photographing volcanoes?
I was a press photographer in Taranaki, which there is the Maunga Taranaki, the Mount Taranaki, which we all lived under, which is a dormant volcano, which might, it's overdue waking up. And every day you woke up, it was a clear sky, you'd see the volcano, it was just always there. And I sort of wanted to move into a go from press photography into broadcast news. And I met a guy called Jeff Mackley, who was just in love with volcanoes. And we built up a really good friendship. I started shooting news with him in Auckland. And we started traveling around the world chasing tornadoes and typhoons and tsunamis and volcanoes was just a natural part of that. Generally, we got to the stage, if people were running away, we were heading into that direction. We used to joke that we were volcano chasers, but as my partner would say, they're not going anywhere. And I was, well, it gives you the opportunity to catch up to them a lot easier when they're not going anywhere. But I caught up with another press cameraman, and we started working together, and he had an idea of going into volcanoes and filming them and then just sort of using the footage from that to help us get to another one. And I was extremely comfortable in volcanoes, and we were very, very successful when we started out. So I think he had been trying before me, and he wasn't successful into getting to the lava lake at Murrum until I joined the team. And from there, we just started going to volcanoes around the world. Sounds really, really weird, but it was just, I've been around volcanoes. I've always been intrigued. I guess it's part of trying to get that dopamine hit. You know, I've had roles where it's basically a whole dump of adrenaline, and it was quite exciting going to these places where people would not venture to and would run away. Yet millions of people around the world depend on volcanoes and the fertile soils to survive. So on one way, I was going into an area, you know, there's only a few of us that were going to it. So it sort of allowed myself to get photos that were a little bit unique and a little bit different.
You've talked about each volcano having its own energy. I'd love to hear about what you mean by that and which volcano's energy captivated you.
Well, I guess every single volcano that you go to has that personality. It all depends where in the world it is, what's around it, the communities, the culture, the people that live around it. That all influences the area. When you get up and you get close or you get inside, each volcano is different. You know, there are families of volcanoes. Each one has little personalities that you notice when you're there for a long time. Murrum, which was a volcano in Ambrim in Vanuatu, which had a lava lake, it was just this immense power, this immense source of energy just coming out of that volcano. And when you look in, you know, it's got this its own environment. It's microclimate because of the toxic gases that are coming out of it constantly. 5 days out of every seven, it was pouring with rain up there. You had pilae hairs, which is fine bits of almost like glass floating down.
Can I stop you right there and ask about how you protect yourself? Because I imagine going up to a volcano and what you just said, it sounds like you could really get hurt. How do you protect yourself?
Yes, you can. Well, when you go into a volcano, you know that you are it and your buddies around you are it if anybody does get hurt. So there's that. So if you do get hurt, yeah.
But I mean, do you have like some Kevlar or something or a helmet or like a umbrella sticking out of your head or something?
Yeah. There's a company in New Zealand called Pacific Helmets that make fireman helmets and rescue helmets. And we went to the factory, were shown around. They were developing a rescue type helmet, which they gave us a few.
Does it have some cool like volcano decals on it or anything?
No, it's the sulfur is eating away at the the metal parts of it, and the leather is slowly degrading. But the helmet itself is nice and safe.
So, and what about your body? Like a fireman's jacket or something?
Yes and no. We would have we call it a heat suit, or it's called a heat proximity suit. And so we would have it would deflect the heat, so it's relatively cool. But if you didn't have that right layer on the inside, your arms would touch the surface of the jacket and it would sort of, you know, burn. We had our gas masks, which were specific for the chemicals that were in the air. We had visors. We took all the safety gear, but I always found climbing and abseiling inside the volcano, I would get too hot wearing the gear. So I ended up just wearing, you know, a pair of like military pants that had the hard knee pads in them.
Let's talk about the camera gear. How do you protect this, I'm sure, expensive, amazing machinery from melting in your hands?
You say, how do I protect it? I don't think I did a very good job. I think I had one camera that I took in for repair, and when they took it apart, they described the inside as it having been flooded, that it having been underwater, that the gases from the volcano had completely sort of rusted up and destroyed and corroded the inside of the camera. So there were things that every time I would go into a volcano, I'd learn something new about the environment and how corrosive it was. I think the last times I went in, I actually had waterproof bags. So I would seal it in the waterproof bags. I would carry them down, just hanging off my harnesses. And that would, you know, keep it out of the environment for as long as possible. Then I would take it out, do filming. But of course, you can only do filming for a certain amount of time.
And this is a digital camera, right?
Yes. I only took digital. It would make sense to actually have taken film now that I think about it. But
you're welcome.
You don't want, yeah, thank you. You don't want the emotions that have been washed away. But yeah, I've had a camera where, you know, I was filming halfway inside a volcano. I was on a ledge. It might have been, I think, about 100 yards inside. And, you know, I quickly turned to grab another battery. And as I turned, a bit of wind just knocked it over and that went flying. And, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of batteries went flying into the volcano.
Do they at least make some cool, like, explosion noises when they landed in the lava?
No. Well, if I was that close, yeah. Basically, it would go down into the crater, the crater floor, and then I'd never ever see it again. I've been filming on the last edge, the Tephra Dam, before the you know, the actual lava lake, and you could only film for a very short amount of time. That particular camera, the LCD screen, started to smoke or started to steam up, and the back of it started to warp. You know, I was holding up a piddly little leather glove, a gardening glove, and I was trying to hold it over in front of the camera to stop that direct heat. Yeah, so of course, you can only do this for a very short time.
How long are we talking? 15 minutes?
The actual filming, I would be lucky to do over a minute at a time. If I was able to do it from further back, I could zoom in and do it longer. But when I was on the Tephra Dam edge, you know, we're talking about lava that is coming out at 1200 degrees Celsius. Yeah, so it destroys everything. And I'm pretty sure it's destroyed part of my body as well.
Right. Well, that was my next question. Did you ever get hurt?
Yes, I did get hurt.
Tell me about it.
The first time I ever got burnt inside a volcano, it was from the fuel that we carried down for the ActSafe Ascender, which was like a little mechanized winch that we would hold. It was like holding a small Honda engine, and it would attach to the ropes, and we would just pull ourselves up out of the volcano using these little motorized ascenders. So, of course, you had to take fuel down. This particular time, my partner, who got stuck climbing inside, I had to go up, take his backpack off him, and I clipped that backpack to myself. His fuel wasn't in the aluminium cans. It was in a drink bottle. And it was put on the side, and it poured throughout my groin. And I was halfway inside this volcano trying to work out what this warm sensation in my groin was. It wasn't a good sensation. And it took a few seconds to realize that it was fuel. And of course, I was stuck there. I had a harness which kept it all pulled inside. And I basically, it took 40 minutes to get out of the volcano and start washing myself down at the campsite that we had at the top of the volcano.
So you had fuel leaking onto your groin.
Yes.
As you are working your way out of a volcano.
Yes. And then luckily it was raining for most of that week, and I was able to recover purely because I had pretty much like second degree burns on my inner thighs, which, yes, I was wearing a lava, which I'm not sure, you know, if you know what a lava.
A lava?
Yes, a lava is basically like just a piece of material, like wearing a towel at the beach. So you wrap yourself around with the lava. So I was airing myself out, replacing my dressings twice a day, waiting for the rain to stop. The part that was injured the most was where the harness was, because that was on my thighs. That's where the petrol had pulled, and I was rubbing as I was climbing and getting out. Yeah. So when I got to the top, I just basically stripped off and just washed myself with as much water as I could.
The world's most dangerous nudist resort.
Yes. Other times I've been inside, and obviously you're inside a crater that not many people have been inside. A lot of them, only we had been inside. So if somebody else is coming down above you, it knocks those rocks down. And so you're watching, you know, these mini missiles coming, shooting past you. I think the worst one was I was hit in my shoulder as I was trying to move to a safe spot. And I'm pretty sure that I had a bit of a fracture that took quite a few weeks. But we were up there and we were stuck and there was no help. So it was basically, you know, a bit of paracetamol and ibuprofen and that was it.
We are talking to you because you take great pictures of volcanoes. So what makes a great volcano picture?
Okay, I think what makes a great volcano picture is being in a position where not many people are able to get that shot. And with volcanoes, it means getting inside and getting up and as close as possible to that lava. You know, I take a photograph. Do I like it? Yeah, I'll take another one. So it's just trying it and redoing it and trying different times. One of the closest calls I had was inside Murrum Volcano, where I was just down inside the volcano by myself. I'm pretty sure that Toronto Needle? Is that the
Space Needle in Seattle?
Yes. How does it say how tall it is?
Well, since we're pre-taped and I can look this up, hold on. How tall is Seattle Space Needle? 605 feet tall.
Feet out. Okay, what's that in meters?
Oh, 605, 2 meters. 184 meters.
Okay. So the Murrum Volcano, which was the first crater that I ever got down to the crater floor, the Space Needle could fit in there with another, I would say, 200 feet to spare.
And you're alone.
Yeah, it's just a little ant at the bottom. And I could, you know, every now and again, you would look up and you would see somebody peering over the crater's edge. And one of these times, I'd actually taken a microbiologist down. I gave him my heat suit jacket because, you know, I'll protect him rather than myself because I
chivalrous of you, Brad.
Well, I always found that I'd get too hot. Ironically, I'd get too hot, I would sweat too much, and then I'd need twice as much water. So I would climb down with the minimum gear, the safety helmet, the visor, the gloves, the boots, and the gas mask. And this time, he was searching for new lava bombs that had come out because he wanted to see what sort of life was there, what sort of microbiomes.
Extremophiles?
Well, possibly. I'll just nod my head and say yes. So he was there and he was in the water course out of my view. So I went to the edge and I started filming away. I'd put the GoPro going and I had my camera and a tripod. And I was filming away, and this particular time, the volcano was so active. The lava lake was a lot higher than usual, and it was just like this angry, you know, we're talking about different personalities. She was very angry, and I was watching it bubble and trying to get this footage, and I just heard this whooshing sound as the lava went up, it dropped, and then it spat out. And shot spatter over me. And it was enough time for me to realize what was happening. And I thought, oh, great, this is going to hurt. And it went flying over me. I only got hit with one small bit of spatter and it hit my hand. And because of the sweat, it just bounced off and felt like a mosquito sting. And I was half expecting, you know, it to burn through my bag and my shirt. And it missed me.
I saved the hardest question for the end. Which of the 16 volcanoes that you photographed was the most freaking awesome?
The most freaking... No, did I get that accent right? No. The most freaking... Freaking?
Yeah, that's it. Freaking. Okay. You could do freaking or freaking.
Freaking.
But there's no R rolling. No.
Okay. The most amazing volcano that I had ever been inside was Nyiri Gongo. And that is over 500 meters inside to get to that crater floor. And I made that descent twice. It was awe-inspiring, the power. It was the largest volcano, or the I think the the largest in circumference in the world that was still active. And there were like three different levels to the volcano when you're inside it. And to be the only one there, the adrenaline going through, it was an amazing experience. I try to describe that I'm walking over thin crusts of lava, and some of that is breaking underfoot. It's so hard to explain.
But we know what it smells like.
We do, and that volcano, you know, others had been there in the past, and it. So in that aspect, it wasn't a unique place I'd been to, but, you know, having it's such a difficult place to get to, you know, to get to the Congo, we had to fly into Ethiopia, and then we had to go through the border and pay a lot of money to be there. We had to have a lot of fixes. We had to have safety, you know, a security team just to get there. The United Nations, they helped us to a certain point. We had some very crazy Ukrainian pilots who tried to fly us up. And one thing you don't want is a whiteout when you're flying near a volcano. And there was apparently a lot of chatter in the cockpit talking about where we are and what we're doing. And we came out of that unscathed. And there were rebels out there. United Nations were protecting the population. So it was a very difficult place to get to. The first time I went to the Congo, I said I'd never ever do it again. The second time, I was like, why am I here? But that particular time was when I was able to get inside the volcano, get some amazing footage.
Well, kakite, Brad White.
I love that. Kakite ano. Thank you, Kayone.
We'll have links to some of Brad's beautiful photos at ctpublic.org/audacious. When we get back, why did Leif Carlstrom and his team turn 10 years of volcanic data into music?
We're trying to piece together a story. So listening to it sometimes gives you new insights as to what processes might be responsible for the signals you see.
Plus, how one pizza chef became inspired to move his kitchen into a location with a little more heat.
It started when I saw the volcano to begin with. So one day I decided something beautiful can happen here.
I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious. Stay with me. Oh no. I think he's about to blow. No, that's a volcano. And it's about to blow. We've gotta go. Run faster. Before the floor is lava. Quick and tectonic plates on.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf. Today we're meeting people who take their love of volcanoes to new heights, or depths. Later, you'll meet a guy who cooks pizzas in a volcanic cave. But right now, I want you to relax, take a deep breath, and listen to what 10 years of one volcano's activity data sounds like, condensed into a 3-minute-long song. It's called Hotel Kilauea. Leif Leif Carlstrom is a volcanologist, musician, and associate professor of earth sciences at the University of Oregon. And this music is thanks to him and his team at the Volcano Listening Project. Leif got the idea after talking with Ben Holtzman, a colleague who was producing music-like audio from recordings of earthquakes. Now, when you think about the sounds a volcano makes, rumbling, spurting, lava flow probably come to mind, but that's not exactly what you're hearing. So what kind of sounds is he interpreting here?
So, of course, volcanoes do make sounds that we can hear, but the human auditory band is sort of pathetically small, right? We can hear between 20 hertz and 20 kilohertz, roughly, about three orders of magnitude, and a variety of signals happen outside that band. So the volcano is making sounds of all kinds, some of them directly sort of hearable if you were to speed it up or slow it down. And so some of what I do is simply that, right? Like if you measure seismic shaking of the ground at a volcano, that typically occurs below the auditory bands, but it's an oscillatory waveform. So you could simply speed it up and then you can directly hear it. Sometimes we might be interested in ultrasonic frequencies. And in that case, you slow it down. But that's a particular type of data. And there are other things that are happening at volcanoes that we might want to listen to, which are not simply like oscillatory, like waveforms. And then we have to make other choices about how we turn that into sound.
So for those who may be hearing the music that you've made, and we'll play some clips, they may think, oh, that's interesting, or that's cool. So what? What do we learn from this music?
First of all, it might be enough to just sort of say that's cool. And that's sort of the whole point, actually. That's what music does. You say, hey, that's really cool. I'm moved by this. And that's a whole part of this volcano listening project, is actually just making music from volcanic data. If you listen to classical music, you've probably listened to like Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Probably, you know, Vivaldi wasn't taking data about winter and spring as he was composing this music. He was simply just inspired by them, right? And so I think that's a completely valid reason to do this. It is a valid question what you learn from a scientific perspective here. Actually, what we're doing by listening to data is we're sort of seeing that data in a new way, or hearing that data in a new way, as the case may be here. Anytime you experience data in a new way, you get new ideas, particularly for complex data that are so common in Earth systems. A volcano is something that we don't get to see inside, right? All the dynamics are hidden beneath the surface, and usually on timescales that are not on human scales, right? Like a major volcanic cycle, not uncommon for it to be hundreds or thousands of years even between big eruptions. Volcanoes are very complex Earth systems that involve, you know, the melting of rocks deep in the mantle, the ascent and the chemical evolution of that magma as it ascends through the crust, and then a final progression through the surface, oftentimes driven by bubbles. And that happens on a very short time scale, but it reflects this long history, right? And we have not been measuring that history. So we're only seeing very indirectly the dynamics that are going on, which means that, you know, we're data limited. We don't have all the information, and all the different data streams that we gather around volcanoes are telling us slightly different indirect things. And we're trying to piece together a story. So listening to it sometimes gives you new insights as to what processes might be responsible for the signals you see.
So you think it's possible that the sounds and the musical interpretations of them could be part of understanding the life cycle and maybe the predictive nature of volcanoes, if there is such a thing?
Yeah. I mean, I think the example that I'll give for that is an analog system. We generally try to find analogs because of this fact that volcanoes operate outside of human timescales. And it so happens that a lot of the dynamics in volcanic eruptions are also at play in geysers. So we have, for example, studied a geyser at Yellowstone National Park called Lone Star Geyser that erupts really regularly, like every 3 hours, and has been doing so for at least 100 years. People document this. There's a whole community called the Geyser Gazers that do this. So we know this geyser has been very regular, and we went out and instrumented it with all the same instruments that we use at real volcanoes. and gathered a bunch of time series. Now we know sort of why geysers erupt, but there are still open questions there too. What are the physical processes that are involved in the geyser eruption cycle? And so we turn that data into sound. And there is a great example. You have these different data streams that are each sort of probing different aspects of the system. You know, I had a data stream that was sort of capturing when water was coming out of the geyser vent, and it does so in, you know, a pretty complex way. Have a data stream that tells you how the data, the ground around the geyser is deforming. And then you have a seismometer that's telling you high frequency vibrations that are tracking sort of bubbles bursting and water moving in the subsurface. And those things are interacting in a really complex way to tell the story of how the eruption cycle happens. So by sonifying it, you hear the relationship between these things. And that's a research topic, right? We published a couple of research papers on this using, you know, traditional or more traditional techniques. But you could just directly hear that, and we could have saved ourselves a lot of time if we'd started with the sonification.
I'd love to hear you talk about the creation of Hotel Kilauea. I think that would maybe give people a good example for what we're talking about, what it sounds like, and if you could kind of in a nutshell explain the process of how that was made, if there is even a nutshell version of it.
Yeah. So Hotel Kilauea is a great example of this sort of crossover between arts or music making and data. The data that are behind it reflect the opening phase of an eruption at Kilauea volcano in Hawaii that actually spans a decade. So in 2008, a crater opened at Kilauea Summit that then hosted a lava lake for the next 10 years until 2018, when the whole summit collapsed. And that eruption probably people have some familiarity with, because the eruption started with a lava flow or a new vent that opened in a neighborhood on the lower east rift zone of Kilauea volcano. But along with that, there was a collapse of the summit of the volcano, and that lasted several months and sort of ended that eruptive episode. But it started way back in 2008, and even prior to that, with a change in the influx, we think, of magma coming in at depth, sort of originating in the mantle. So the data that we used for that Hotel Kilauea track sort of essentially document the building up to that point where the crater opens. And so there's different data sets that are being represented there. One is the sort of slow, gradual deforming of the volcano summit. And we mapped that onto pitches that are sort of sliding up and down in response to the ground going up and down. There are then more rapid deformation events that are also sort of pulse-like. They're ground deformation. They call them deflation-inflation events that are likely linked to magma sort of moving around between subsurface reservoirs at the summit. And then finally, there's a data set associated with gas release at the surface. And that only happened as the eruption was kind of kicking off. And so you have this gradual building that culminated in the opening of the crater and the start of this big decade-long eruption. So again, three different sort of voices. We sonified them in different ways. And that was the data side of things. We then took that track, so three voices, and gave it to some musicians, I guess myself included. And we then sort of improvised to this. So treated it, in that case, took off my science hat altogether and just asked, what can we make of this musically? And it ends up being, I would say, you know, a bit of avant-garde music in some sense, right? It's free improvisations, free jazz in some sense. We had some constraints that we talked about beforehand in terms of a melodic framework or harmonic framework that we were going to use. But more or less, we're reacting to the sounds that were made by the volcano in this case, and to each other. And so the volcano just becomes another player, another voice in the composition. And so from that standpoint, just as a piece of improvisation that we made.
In this piece, you have two violins, a stand-up bass, and a guitar. Why not a marimba or a toy piano or a pipe organ?
Yeah, I don't play those.
But is it, I mean, we could maybe have like a volume two, a remix. If there was a remix, of Hotel Kilauea. What would you like? What perhaps EDM, 8-bit, trap?
Yeah, I think that's the beautiful thing about this sort of approach is that others can reinterpret it. And I would love to see some other people do this. I'll say that we have been building out other examples of this kind of performance to volcanic data. It's a project that's in the works now. I'm actually mostly done with it. And so we have, I guess, 12 or 13 different examples of volcanic sonifications that I've done this with, not necessarily playing myself, but giving to other people. And so we have everything from steel guitar. Somebody did a sort of composed a poem and sang a poem over one of these things. Just a wide variety of different interpretations. And the point there again is purely aesthetic, right? What kind of music can you create and be inspired by this sort of volcanic data source? It turns out volcanic data has a very musical structure often, right? There's a natural arc of tension and release involved in a volcanic event, which lends itself quite well to music.
What's the difference between a volcano that makes music that kind of sounds like a horror movie, which Hotel Kilauea sounds like, and maybe something that sounds a little more hopeful or gentle or funny?
I guess there's a couple of parts to that. There are some choices that we made in the sonification that lend themselves to a particular musical interpretation. And specifically, I'm referring to the choice of scale that was used to sonify some of the data. So the choice that we made for the ground deformation data was to map to what's called a diminished or octatonic scale, which is the most symmetric musical scale that exists. It's a whole step followed by a half step, followed by a whole step, followed by a half step, followed by a whole step. It's the least biased, I guess, of any musical scale. So from the sonification perspective, that's actually quite important to me, that I'm not introducing artificial biases in the data. But as a result, the diminished scale actually is a bit of an ominous sounding scale. It's often used in jazz, but is not it's not common in like our traditional idioms of Western classical music or pop music for that matter. Right. So right off the top of the thing, you're given a track that sounds a little bit dark. And then we chose to improvise in a diminished scale as well, right, to match that. So there are examples, and we've done this, where we make different choices about the scales that are used. If I used a Lydian scale or a mode as opposed to an octatonic scale, that actually has a much more hopeful connotation to it. And the resulting music has that vibe to it as well. So it's composition practice, just like any composer does, I suppose.
Leif Carlstrom, thank you so much for talking with me.
Of course, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll have a link to more music from Leif and his team at the Volcano Listening Project at ctpublic.org/audacious. After the break, does anybody want to grab some pizza on an active volcano? I'm buying.
One time I was serving the pizza and I gave it to my customer and then the volcano decided to randomly explode.
Okay, this pizza may require travel insurance. I'm Kion Wolf. This is Audacious. Be right back. You might be in for a big surprise when you're living on a volcano. When's it gonna blow?
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Many factors impact a child's achievement. To start, they need the basics like access to healthy food and quality health care. Join me, Lucy Nalpathanchil, as Connecticut Public and the Connecticut Black and Brown Student Union host a one-hour conversation about the importance of safe housing. Wednesday, May 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Guard Arts Center in New London. Register at ctpublic.org/safehousing.
Yes, I'd like to order a medium pizza with pepperoni and extra onions. Oh, and I'd like it well done, please. Pick up? Oh, wait, is this the pizza joint in Guatemala where everything is cooked using the heat from flowing lava on top of the Pacaya volcano? Do you do delivery? Okay, let me call you back. This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf, and if you have a hankering for pizza that's been cooked inside a volcano, there's really only one guy you want to order from. David Garcia has been slinging pies on top of Guatemala's Pacaya volcano since 2013, and at first, business was slow as a dormant volcano's lava flow. But now, after repeatedly going viral, business is nonstop, like a very active volcano's lava flow. Reservations were full every single day last year. I asked David to talk about how all this came to be, and we are grateful to Miguel Martinez for interpreting for us.
Bueno, yo tengo un restaurante antes de empezar con la pizzería, y desde pequeño me ha gustado mucho la cocina.
So I've actually always loved cooking since I was little. And I have my own restaurant. It started when I saw the volcano to begin with. And I saw guys that they roasted marshmallows there. So one day I decided something beautiful can happen here. And for the first few days, I would go down and I would make pizza for myself personally. So not for any customers or any restaurant, just for myself.
I bet that this was not something that you just figured out one day and then the pizza came out perfectly. So talk about the process, the trial and error that went into making the perfect volcanic pizza.
Let me start by saying that there is no manual on how to make a volcanic pizza. I made the manual. It took me 5 years of practice of making pizza in different types of ovens. So I started with a very extremely hot oven that had like fumes of sulfur. And then I started with a different type of oven that steam came out of it. It was a steam oven instead. And that was the hardest one because it was perfect to make vegetables where they would be boiled instead. But the pizza would not come out golden, how it should come out. So it took me a long, long 5 years of practice on how eating different types of pizza made from the volcanoes and tasting it with the sulfur to see how the people would react to eating them, testing it on myself. And at some point, I used the lava itself where I put the pizza on the lava and I would go down the volcano and wait until the pizza slowly with the lava went down while it cooked until it got to the place I was. And then I would taste it to see if it needed anything, it needed more cooking, etc.
How does your pizza, cooked on a volcano, taste different than any other pizza in the world?
So the first thing you're going to feel once you put it in your mouth is an explosion of flavor. This pizza is absolutely nothing like a pizza that is from a store. And the reason is because of the way that the volcano has to be an exact temperature and takes an exact amount of length too. So in a cave, because there's steam coming out from the ovens in there, the whole cave ends up being covered in water. So it's dripping water. I combine wood to make firewood, and I combine carbon as well, as if I was making a grill. And that actually dries up the cave because turns out that the volcano is always blowing air. So it does it on its own. So it mixes all of those on the dough. By the way, the dough, it's all made by herself by hand. And they're what we call mother dough because we keep the doughs resting for about 4 days before we do anything with it. And it doesn't come from any store. So we make it ourselves and we marinate it. And then they also absorb all the fumes from the volcano, plus the firewood, plus the carbon. Very distinct.
When I think about being on a volcano, I think, well, that's very dangerous. Is it dangerous?
Well, I have two stories. One of them, I was with a family and the volcano started acting weird. And you get to know volcanoes while being there for so long. So I told my partners, pick up your stuff and let's go. And the mother asked why. And I said, please just trust me, let's go. So we ended up walking away. And as soon as we got to the safe place, the volcano exploded and there was rocks going all around us. And the kids went, we're like, oh no, we're going to die. And he's like, no, don't worry. We're in a safe area. So that's one of the stories. The other story was that one time I was serving the pizza and I gave it to my customer and then the volcano decided to randomly explode. And when it exploded, there was ash falling all over us like snow. But we're always paying attention to how it's going and if there's any volcanic activity so that we avoid days that there are volcanic activities and it's more active. That way, we can either postpone the reservations people have made with us or cancel them, depending on if it's very active or not, so we don't risk our lives.
When I look at your Instagram, I see, oh, so many people who come to visit and order pizza. How many people would you say you serve in a typical week? And what are these people like? Who are they? Where are they from? Tell me everything.
It completely varies. It depends on season. We get from 200 to 300 on low amounts. And then on higher amounts, we get from 300 to 400. It really depends. A lot of the people that come are students of volcanology from the United States. So the school sends them on a trip and they end up, because there's a lot of volcanoes here in Guatemala, and they end up coming to my volcano to get some pizza and see how, study how pizza can be made on a volcano. Another thing that I've seen a lot of is businesses. So big businesses, there was this pharmaceutical business that is worldwide that sent one people from 88 different places on the world to enjoy some pizza, volcanic pizza. And then on top of that, I also seen people from Africa, from Russia, from the United States, from Canada, from islands I've never even knew existed. I've never even heard before. They come from everywhere around the world and mostly from the United States.
A regular size pizza is $35. A larger one is $55. Is that still the price?
Yes. Now, there is a possibility that when lava starts seeping out, the price is going to go up, but I'm not sure yet.
Have you ever had anybody react to the price and be like, ugh, too expensive?
So I've gotten a range of people. I've gotten the absolutely not. In America, it's only $7. Why would I pay $35 for a small pizza? The people that are mostly offended are Italians. Italians come here and they're like, how could you sell pizza for $35, this so small pizza, when in Italia, it's only 7 euros. How could you do this? And then I got this one person who commented, this is absolutely blasphemy to what we do. The reason is we created pizza. So you come up with this insane, crazy pizza idea, which is genius. You turn our culture around and then you present it to the world and it's accepted. And then there's other people that come and they're like, this is absolutely too expensive, but I want to taste it. I think it's worth it because it's the only volcanic pizza in the world. And then they say that they have never tasted a more amazing pizza ever in their lives.
Now, you have spent so long perfecting the recipe, perfecting the methods by which you cook your pizza. But that being said, is there any other volcano that would be so much fun to cook a pizza on?
Yes. In fact, I'm actually planning on going through all of Central America to Italy in one volcano each to make one or two pizzas for each country that I pass by to get to until I get to Italy. Take one or two videos and then keep going until I get to Italy, make a pizza for them with one of their volcanoes, and then get out of there running.
So after you finish making pizza on other people's volcanoes in other countries, what next? Would you like to try cooking different dishes? What would you like to do after you dominate the volcanoes in your area and then, of course, in Italy?
Logistically, it's extremely hard to get the right ingredients for other foods to be cooked in volcanoes. So I don't think that I'll risk that. But for long term, what I'm thinking of doing is opening many pizzerias now with the name Pacaya Pizzas from Guatemala. So born in Guatemala and then spreads around the world so that everyone can have at least have access to volcanic pizza wherever they are without having to come all the way to Guatemala. So in long term, I'm definitely thinking of expanding to reach out to the world in that sense.
David Garcia y Miguel Martinez, gracias por hablar conmigo.
De nada.
Muchas gracias.
Audacious is always lovingly produced by Khalil Rahman, Jessica Severin DiMartinez, Meg Fitzgerald, Meg Dalton, and Katie Tolarski at Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. If you like this episode, you might like the one we did featuring people who fly into hurricanes and chase tornadoes. Or for something completely different, find the one we did about what it's like having persistent genital arousal disorder. You can hear them all on your favorite podcast app. Stay in touch with me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Kyone Wolf. And you can always send an email to audacious@ctpublic.org. Thanks for listening. Uno, dos, tres, four. Oh,